Food on my table.
Dignity.
Security.
Freedom.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
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 Equality.
Equality.
Remedy.
And protection.
Fairness.
Fair time.
Criticism.
Right.
Work.
Peace.
Losers.
Men.
It's my mistake. Let me make it good. I raise the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum,
identity,
family,
home,
conscience,
expression,
expression.
Expression,
expression,
participation,
democracy,
welfare,
work,
work,
leisure,
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 health,
education,
culture,
human rights,
Cartagena,
solidarity,
responsibility.
Fill in the mortar. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM and over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on SaskTel Max at channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at channel 700. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. My name is Jim Hutchings, and today we have a full house. I asked Patricia Elliott, who is Associate Professor at the School of Journalism at the U of R, if she had any students who'd like to discuss some issues on Human Rights Radio, and four of her students, I guess five now, yes, volunteered. So we're pleased to welcome Trish and four of her J School students, Rafiq Bouyen, Eric Westhaver, Alex Saloum, and Ashley Robinson. Who am I missing?
Creed Martel.
Okay. All right. Now I'm going to ask Trish to kind of preface what's happening here, and sort of
sure.
How we got where we are.
Okay. Thanks, Jim. One of the fun things we get to do at the Journalism School, if you ever come there to study, is we work on a lot of projects. The students today are members of the investigative journalism class. And one of our assignments is to participate in a project, it's called Project Censored. This project began in the U.S. in 1976 in Sonoma, California as a media literacy class and has now spread all over North America. And basically what happens is students all over North America will go out and look for those stories that are not being adequately covered in the news for whatever reason. There may be stories that have been overlooked, censored, but the idea is to go out, find these stories, and 25 stories are featured in a book every year, put together by Project Censored. It's one of the things Walter Cronkite said, that this Project Censored is an organization we should really listen to. It's things that matter to people but haven't made the front pages. So the students have been looking for those kinds of stories. We like to get them to do this because it's a way for them to sort of look outside the boundaries of usual news sources to some of those more unusual news sources, which are the source of great stories that need further coverage. And many of them are human rights stories.
And that's what we're interested in here, you know, on Human Rights Radio. Mm-hmm. So we're really going to, I think we're going to cover a lot of bases in a short time.
Yeah.
Who did we decide? Eric, you're going to...
Indeed.
You're going to go first here. And it's kind of a topic dear to a lot of our hearts. You were having a look at beer.
Yes, it's... Granted, maybe not the most pressing issue human rights-wise around, but it is still an issue that should be looked at. And through my investigation, I concluded that the Canadian beer industry is in quite serious trouble at being altered or changed in some ways by foreign business interests. I did a quick summary look at the top 10 best-selling beers in Ontario. I couldn't get the statistics for Saskatchewan, but for Ontario. And out of the top 10, each beer was owned, brewed, and distributed by a company outside of Canada. And I also took a quick look at different types of beers that are typically considered to be quintessentially Canadian. Labatt's, Molson, several other brands as well. And I discovered that out of the top 10 beers that most people would consider Canadian, almost all of them are under foreign ownership. Labatt's, for example, is owned by Anheuser-Busch InBev, which is based in Belgium. Molson is now partially owned by Coors. It's Molson Coors, that's the name of the company. They still maintain a corporate HQ in Montreal, but for all intents and purposes, they're headquartered in Denver. And I found that very few Canadian brewing companies are actually still based entirely in Canada and still owned entirely in Canada. I think the last major independent Canadian brewer left is Moosehead, operating out of Halifax, and even then they have to rely a lot on American companies for distribution.
That's amazing. You know, not that I drink a lot of beer, but...
Neither do I, but it's still an interesting topic.
But you think of a company, for example, like Molson's. I mean, they're iconic, you know. Didn't they own the Montreal Canadiens for...
I believe members of the Molson family still do. Yeah. They took a bit of a hiatus from owning the team for a while. You've happened to stumble across hockey, and I'm a hockey nerd from a long time back. I know that the Molsons still have a stake in the Canadiens.
Yeah, so it's almost sacrilegious. Almost.
It is, in a way. It seems almost a violation. And to say that... beer and these beer companies are quintessentially Canadian, it might seem like a bit of a reach, but it's the truth. I mean, there are a lot of Canadians, and I'm sure a lot of people in Regina and Saskatchewan, people even listening in now, who would take pride in Canada's standing in the world regarding beer production and beer sales. And the fact that the industry's kind of had the carpet pulled out from under it by wealthy companies from abroad, it just doesn't seem right.
Don't you think things have kind of come full circle in a way? Because I think back in the early days of Canada, the U.S., whatever, I think every town of any size would have its own brewery.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
You know, and because we didn't have the distribution system that we have today. Mm-hmm. And then as distribution came along, well, then it becomes more efficient, mm-hmm. you know, to have things centralized. And so then we ended up with the big names that we had before, you know, Carling, O'Keefe, both of which are gone.
Yeah, both of which are British-owned, I believe. So, and that's not to say that local breweries don't still play a force regionally. I mean, there's a few breweries here in Regina, even, that still produce a product that people want to buy and produce something that people enjoy, but they aren't really a huge presence nationally, and that it also is something to be concerned about.
Did you do any studies as to what the trend is in terms of, say, craft beer compared to national brands?
Well, I've found that craft beer in general, consumption of craft beer has gone up, but not as much as you'd think. Because I've seen recently kind of an explosion of people saying they were interested in craft beer and different varieties of beer, and that's all fine and good, but that at the end of the day, sales of these craft beers have not increased as much as the attention socially and culturally would lead you to believe.
Okay, well, that is, to me, that's kind of an interesting topic. Let's go on to your next topic here, talking about mining companies.
Yes, we're getting a little bit more serious from Canadian beer
to
Canadian mining companies committing some pretty heinous acts. There are a few people listening in today that I know have been paying attention to the story, but in case you haven't been keeping up on this, let me just jog your memory. There have been, over the past 10-15 years, a lot of cases of Canadian-owned mining companies going into third-world countries, or developing countries, rather, and doing some rather heinous things. I can remember one example off the top of my head. In 2002, I believe, a mining company from British Columbia that the name escapes me right now. They had an operation going in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and a local rebellion near the mine was threatening the ongoing operations of the mine and the profits of the company. The company called in security and called in Congolese military, and that led to a large skirmish that left quite a large number of people injured and murdered a lot of civilians with impunity.
That would be Anvil Mining?
That would be it, yes. Mm-hmm. And there are another couple cases. There's another Canadian company that was involved in operations in Latin America and committed some pretty heinous acts there. They, I believe, were tried in an Ontario criminal court for the actions that they did in Guatemala, namely the murder of an activist, a local activist there, and the an assault on another activist that left him permanently paralyzed. Also, there were reports in McLean's and in a couple other major Canadian press outlets about systemic rape conducted by security hired by this firm, and also of forced evictions from people's homes, which is certainly not a matter to be trifled with in the least.
So those would be allegations, or was that proved?
They showed up in a major national magazine. There was a story about this in McLean's.
Okay.
It showed up on a couple of other press outlets, too. I remember I come from a town that deals with one of these companies quite frequently,
mm-hmm.
and there was a bit of press coverage about that locally as well. And I can remember some of the accusations very well. And it became the talk of the town for a little bit. And the company that isn't heavily involved in my hometown was not directly involved in the case, but they bought the company that was, and therefore wound up taking on their legal issues.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Hudbay Minerals. And so if you look at the court documents and such, it winds up saying Hudbay Minerals versus these activists from Guatemala. And just in general, the goings-on by some of these companies in the developing world are just brutal, to say the least.
I think part of the story here, though, too, is that mainstream media kind of ignores this stuff.
Indeed. Well, I would say mostly that it's ignored because it's a long way away from home. Mm-hmm. And also the fact that mentioning this on a major scale would possibly interfere with Canadian business interests. And I know that certain elements of the media may not necessarily appreciate doing that on a regular or even semi-regular basis.
Okay. One totally non-related thing. I'm looking for the stick with the music on for the break.
It's in my pocket. Don't worry. I could give it to you right now if you wish.
All right. I was frantically looking around for it.
That's no problem.
Okay. All right. Now, so we're all set for the break.
Indeed.
All righty. So let's carry on with our next person, and that would be Creedon.
Hi.
So what are you basically looking at, Creedon?
Well, I did my stories on the qualifications that are needed to work as an early childhood educator, as in such, you know, like organizations like a daycare,
mm-hmm.
and basically how the qualifications you need to work in a daycare as opposed to an elementary school
mm-hmm.
are very far apart. I mean, to qualify as an ECE certificate, early childhood education, you need only complete 9 credit hours to get certified for a level 1, and that is 3 classes.
So are we talking about Saskatchewan? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
It's here in Saskatchewan. And in order to, for an elementary school teacher, you need 4 full years of post-secondary education as well as a practicum. So it's, I mean, in both cases, you're dealing with children, and then I think just in one case, one person is heavily underqualified.
Yeah, for sure. Have you checked how Saskatchewan compares with other provinces as far as requirements are concerned? Where is Saskatchewan in sort of the grand scheme of things? Are we sort of in the middle of the pack? Are we really low on the totem pole, or is it pretty average?
I was looking more. I couldn't find any stats, but as far as becoming an elementary school teacher in, you know, Alberta or Manitoba, Saskatchewan is in line with them with, you know, the 4 years that are needed and stuff like that. Unfortunately, I could not find the ECE for those mm-hmm. provinces. I did look in Ontario, which right. are a bit, you know, the qualifications needed are a bit more than, mm-hmm. you know, simply 9 credit hours.
Right, for sure.
Yeah.
Was there anything else you had there, or was that...
I also did a story on the upcoming Bill C-51, which, you know, has received a lot of media coverage, but I felt it was, you know, an important issue nonetheless.
Yeah, it seems to me that with BC-51, things aren't happening as smoothly as the government thought they would.
No, unlike, you know, Bill C-45, which spawned Idle No More, they had resistance there. Bill C-51 is facing opposition from fellow politicians mm. just because of the you know, potential consequences that this will have on people and, you know, Canadians everywhere if it is passed. You know, I got interested in it because I saw an article by Elizabeth May, and mm. she described that this would affect, you know, the simple things that we can do, like protesting and stuff like that. And, you know, as an, I guess, an Aboriginal aspiring journalist, I was hoping to cover, you know, the events such as Idle No More and protests, which, you know, would fall under the jurisdiction of Bill C-51 if it were to go through.
If you've taken part in sort of demonstrations of any size, one thing that's startling these days is the number of cops with cameras. You know, if you're participating, I was in the G20 march around Toronto, and pretty well on every street corner, you got your picture taken, you know, so I'm sure they got a lovely file. I don't know, maybe I'm flattering myself here, whether they have a file on me or not. Not sure. I was there with Amnesty.
Oh, I'm sure they do.
But, yeah.
Yeah. No doubt.
But this is something now that I think that people have to, you know, take account of. If you're going to become active, if you're going to be an activist of any kind, you're going to get the attention of the authorities.
Yeah,
just
absolutely.
That simple. But Tommy Douglas did too, so I think I'm in good company, yeah. And you too.
Yeah,
so, what else have you been looking at?
Well, this interested me because there are a lot of Native protesters, you know, regarding the Keystone Pipeline,
right?
That's, you know, that was just recently vetoed by President Obama, and people would, you know, it's a standard form of protest to set up blockades, which usually do result in, you know, arrests, but under, you know, Bill C-51, it would result in harsher penalties and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of people. from academics to lawyers, commentators of various stripes, who cannot see the need for Bill C-51. They'll tell you that we have the laws we need now to look after the things that Prime Minister Harper is claiming we need to look after. And they're already looked after, so this is very political.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
All right, so is that basically it? We're going to move on?
Yeah, that's the gist of it, yeah.
Okay, very good, Creighton, and I understand you have to head out. So
yes, I do.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
All righty, and Ashley is next up here.
Yes, I am.
And so what have you been up to, Ashley?
Well, one of the things that I looked into was the town of Lac-Mégantic. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. I'm not that good at French. But as everyone knows, that town, I think it was in 2013 or 2012, there was a train explosion there that killed a number of people in the town. And it completely changed how people look at what travels on the railroads. And I was quite startled when I was going through alternative media and found out that as of January 2016, dangerous goods trains will be returning to that town. They will be running on the same tracks as they did before. And the town's not happy about it, and I wouldn't be either. It was just, I think, 6 months or something, or about a year after the explosion happened, trains returned to traveling through that town, but they were told that they would only have dry goods traveling over the trains, and that was followed. But there was a memorandum or something put on it that only for so long it would be that way. So that memorandum expires in January 2016. And at that time, dangerous goods trains will travel through the town. And the townspeople have fought to have the train tracks rerouted around town. But the government has said that they can't do anything about it, and instead it's up to the company that owns the train tracks, which is owned by Fortress Investment Group. And they've said, no, we're not doing it because it's too expensive. So this town is left with the fact that they could have another train explosion happen. And yes, there have been rules changed with how the trains, for watching them and for controlling them, travel. But as we saw last year here in Saskatchewan ourselves with the town of Clare, that doesn't always change things, and it's scary to think. And one of the things that I found really surprising when I was researching this was that I found out that the Bakken oil, the shale formation that's in North Dakota and down south here in Canada, in here in Saskatchewan and Manitoba, the oil, the crude oil in that is more explosive than gasoline, or is just as explosive as gasoline.
It's very light.
Yes, and that was the crude oil that exploded in Lac-Mégantic. And I think that's scary for us here in the prairies, because we're dealing with those trains rolling over our tracks too. So I don't think this just affects Lac-Mégantic. I think it affects everyone.
Part of the issue, of course, is them using substandard rail cars to transport this oil. Is there any sign of that situation changing?
Some of the reports I read, they are trying to phase out these older train cars and everything. But I remember when I was working on another story back a few years ago when I used to work on a newspaper, and I was listening to a safety person for the oil field talk, and she was saying about how her and her kids, when they're bored, they sit at train tracks. And they flip through her book of all the different symbols that say what's traveling on the trains. Mm-hmm. And the kids they'll see wherever the symbol is. And then the kids will look up in the book to see what it is. And she said, you would not believe what's traveling on these train tracks through our communities. And just when you're stopped at the train, you won't believe what's in front of you.
Yes, and when it comes to rerouting train tracks, like Mégantic would like to have the train tracks rerouted so it doesn't go through their town. Well, you know, good luck with that. You'll notice that with our rail relocation project here in Regina, the main line continues to go through the city and will continue to go through the city. People, I think, thought at first that we'd have the main line rerouted around the city, so we wouldn't have to worry about dangerous goods coming through, but the dangerous goods will continue to come through Regina.
Just, and that's the thing, you can't reroute it for every town and city in this country. There's no way. But it's still scary, and something needs to be done to protect people so that things like Lac du Magnétique does not happen again.
Yeah, it's pretty scary. It's... I think people were just astounded at the damage that happened in a very short time. Is there going to be any change in the way the trains are manned? Like, there was one person running that train.
Yeah, they're actually going to... I was reading just this morning. I was re-looking through my information so that I'd be a bit more knowledgeable on the subject again. They are working on changing how the trains are manned and who's watching them and stuff, because at the time that train wasn't watched. It had been left by itself. And now they're working to change that. But the thing is, how long it's taking to get these laws into effect. The U.S. is working on it in Canada. But the question is, once these laws get in effect, is anyone going to follow them?
Interesting story, and we'll keep tabs on it for sure. And you had another one here about another issue, anti-blackness in Canada.
Yes, racism is always a hot issue in any country now in the world. But the thing is, with this story, I was looking into it, and it completely struck a chord with me, because when you look at the education system and the media here in the country, here in Canada, we don't really cover anything when it comes to racism, except for racism against First Nations, which I will agree, of course, is important, and also the struggles of Francophones in Quebec. But there's other racisms, and there's other racism problems in this country and other struggles that people are having. And one of them is the fact that there's all this racism against African Americans here in the country, and it's not getting covered as it is in the States. And as we've seen in the last year in the States with the protests in Ferguson, it's a very important matter. And when I was looking into this, I found a lot of things, like comparing the what happened in Ferguson to racism here in Canada against First Nations, but I couldn't find anything really saying about our racism towards African Americans or even Muslims or Latinos. I just think it's crazy. And when you look at the education system, I came up through the education system, of course, here in Canada, and the fact that we don't study other religions and other faiths and other... Just we don't study anything else except for really European history, focusing, of course, on Britain and France, because those are the countries that settled this. Those are the countries that settled here, and also First Nations history, which I agree is important, and I'm happy I learned those things. But I would also like to know more about First Nations history. I mean, African Americans history and Muslim history, because we are a multicultural country, and if we're going to say that we are, we should know more about those. And like, as I said in my report, most people, what you know about it is the Underground Railroad and the Book of Negroes, which has been a lot in the press lately because of the miniseries that CBC did. But we don't really know much else besides those. And in Canada, we had African American slaves the same as the States. We just didn't have the same extent, but we still did.
Yes, and I think Canadians tend to be a little smug about our... You know, acceptance of people, and we don't think of ourselves as racist, but
you start to
scratch the surface there, and you find a totally different story. Mm-hmm. There are places, and the one that comes to mind immediately is Halifax.
Yes,
with Africville, where the city of Halifax just went in and bulldozed the whole place.
Yeah, and the thing is, I was looking at some of the places in Halifax, and there's also, like, Nigger Rock and stuff. And most of the time, those places are just kind of swept under the rug and ignored. And the fact that the name of that, just as soon as you hear that, it makes your eyebrows raise. And the thing is, if you look a lot into the history in Nova Scotia and Halifax and stuff, a lot of their history is tied with African Americans. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, how many Canadians know that?
For sure. I think over the past years, I'm just thinking of my own education, and you're talking about what you've experienced a little later. Mine is
just a couple of years.
In the dark ages. but I think an awful lot more needs to be done in our education system. We'll be right back.
says, come on, come on in.
Alrighty, now you're going to tell me all about this, Alec.
All about this song, yeah. So Come On Eileen is a bit of a class favorite of ours.
Oh, oh, there's something else on it.
Oh.
On so fondly today, were to suddenly leave you or fly in the night, just like fairy gifts gone in the sky.
We're not sure what that is. It's a mystery audio file.
I guess so, yeah.
Anyway, tell us about...
Absolutely. So this song is a bit of a class favorite of ours. Towards the end of last semester, which was our first semester of journalism, we ended up working on a project, which ended up being the Project from Hell. We ended up, a few of us, editing for about, I want to say, 50 hours to get this thing done. And at the very end of it, we, to let off some steam, went to our campus bar, and on our walk back to the class, we sang this all throughout the hallway, played it in the lab, and had a bit of a dance party. So it's a song that has a place in all of our hearts, and whenever we're around each other, we try to sing it or, you know, do it as a karaoke song.
Awesome.
Yeah. So that's the significance of Come On Eileen to...
So if anybody wants to join your group, they have to learn this song.
Absolutely. It's it's a prereq for applying to the J school.
All right. Well, let's carry on to something maybe just equally important as the song. And this is... there are so many of these stories coming from the States. This is a convicted eco-anarchist released 9 years into a 20-year sentence. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. That is Mr. Eric McDavid, who in January of 2006 was arrested for conspiring to bomb several dam sites, radio towers, etc. across California. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing about this is that it was later revealed that the FBI had a planted informant. Who had the code name of Anna. It's all that she's been known as. Mm-hmm. And Eric was convicted for 20 years for this. To his credit, during his sentence, he demanded that he only have vegan food in prison. He took hunger strikes, he took stands, and he carried on his activist tradition throughout his prison sentence.
Wow.
Thankfully, mm-hmm. he was released in 2015, this year, on January 10th. And this is after about a few thousand pages of documents were released that at the original time of the trial weren't there. Documents right. about essentially how Anna entrapped Eric using love letters, saying, you know, kind of trying to entice him into doing these things.
Right.
It was revealed that Anna would go as far as flying people across the country to meet up and partake in demonstrations to teach them how to make bombs. She would even go as far as to pay for bomb-making supplies and give lessons on how to make them and effectively detonate.
And all the time she was an FBI agent.
The entire time she was a plant.
Wow.
Yeah, and again, played with his heartstrings, got an entire group interested in doing this, kind of pushed them into it, and it brings up that ever-increasing, increasingly terrifying notion of entrapment,
mm-hmm.
right? And for activist communities, for any organizer, there's always that bit of leeriness as to who you can trust.
Right.
Right? So when you have the FBI infiltrating a group like these eco-anarchists who, mm-hmm. you know, did demonstrations against big farms, against dam sites, against tar sands, against pipelines, etc., when even they are infiltrated by FBI agents,
oh, sure.
everybody becomes suspect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not uncommon here in Canada.
No, it isn't. I mean, again, even with Halifax, you had I think there was a case there where there's two people who were going to go on a shooting spree. There was a RCMP officer planted there. I mean, again, thankfully there was somebody there mm-hmm. that could actually, you know, coalesce this and
a positive result.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But I mean, also you had a case in Alberta, I think in 2001, where the RCMP tried to stage a bombing on a pipeline to try to draw up support for, you know, hey, let's rally against these eco-terrorists is the term that's used.
I guess it kind of begs the question, how far should these law enforcement people go to stop the bad guys?
Yeah. Exactly. And again, in this case, it's very much a perceived yeah. bad guy, quote
right,
unquote.
Right. And so how often when they do something like this, are they actually provoking something that otherwise wouldn't happen?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's that self-fulfilling prophecy, I guess. And with the case of Eric McDavid, especially, you in the wake of 9/11, you had all of these aggressive terror policies come into effect.
Mm-hmm.
And the capturing of these few people, it was a cell of three other people, I think. This was touted as being a triumph for these laws,
right.
for domestic terror being nipped in the bud. Mm-hmm. And it was done through FBI entrapment.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, they entrapped somebody who was basically innocent or would have been innocent if
yeah.
they hadn't, I don't know, it just...
No, and the crazy thing, too, is that it came up during the retrial, during his release, that the mm-hmm. FBI had withheld information.
Right.
Eric McDavid's lawyer, Mark Reichel, had conducted FOI requests for certain information and was stonewalled in just about every attempt he made.
Mm-hmm.
It again, the thousands of documents that were released were essentially exactly what he was looking for at the time, but at the end of the day, Eric still served 9 years in jail.
So do you have an idea what the breaking point was there? Like, why was he finally able, why was his lawyer finally able to sort of get over the stonewalling?
You know what? I'm not too sure, because the statute of limitations wouldn't have expired on that by any stretch. I think probably what happened is greater literacy in FOI requests, in government surveillance, and just a greater public leeriness to accepting the party bylines that are given to us. I think basically you had a bit more critical thought. You had outpouring to support for Eric, and I'd say just that attention is what ultimately saved him and got him out of jail.
Okay, well, that's a good news story for sure. You know, it's one of those things that there are so many people who are incarcerated, not just in the States, but
absolutely, yeah.
but lots of them who are in there just through some unfortunate circumstance, being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And boy, once you get in the system, it's really hard to get yourself out.
Of course, because then you're painted as a criminal for the rest of your life and you've got that record.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Next item that you were looking at is the National Energy Board.
Yeah, the NEB, the one government agency that can regulate pipeline development and give approval or denial for upcoming pipelines. Most notably, mm-hmm. it's the Keystone XL
right.
and Energy East.
Yeah.
This story and the underrepresented portion of it is that the NEB is not conducting certain investigations or considerations when they're reviewing pipelines. Most notably, the downstream effect on First Nations communities
mm-hmm.
and also the increased carbon emissions from tar sands. And I'm sure as all of us and your listeners know, tar sands are probably the dirtiest means of extracting oil.
Mm-hmm.
I think that for the Energy East pipeline, over its 40-year lifespan, it'd be the equivalent of putting 30 million cars on the road. I mean, again, these are mind-numbing stats that kind of become irrelevant, but the point is that it is a substantial amount of CO2 emissions coming out,
mm-hmm.
and it needn't be. This is an agency that isn't being held to the standard it should be, and it's negligence that can have some dire effects.
Yeah, for sure. And when you, it's very inefficient.
It is.
Yeah.
Absolutely it is. I mean, that's the thing, is that the whole point of Keystone XL, it's in the news recently, it's taking tar sand oil from Alberta down to, I think it's Texas. It's down all mm-hmm. the way to the southeast coast of the United States
right.
to be refined. It's, again, it's a absurd thing.
I think President Obama has his advisors are basically telling him that in the end you'll have about 35 full-time jobs that are created by this project.
Yeah, and I mean that's
35. That's it. You know,
35. Yeah. And the other thing too, again, to talk about Keystone, you had a $24 million ad campaign funded by taxpayers in Canada to promote it, right? Saying that this will create job creation, this will create this, that, and the other thing. But at the end of the day, you have $24 million that could have been better allocated doing anything, actually creating jobs, investing in sustainable energy, in new technology, whatever it is. It's just...
Contrast that with some European countries, notably Germany, who are basically turning their back on fossil fuels and on nuclear, and they're going with renewables and making great progress. So that's sort of the direction I think maybe we should look at here.
Well, especially in the wake of the crashing crude oil prices. I mean, again, if you're looking for great examples of resource-based economies, look to Russia, where you had global prices drop about 50% and the ruble dropped 46%.
Right.
You have in Canada provincial and national budgets potentially being pushed back.
Yep.
It is absolutely a time to change what we're doing and find some new form of energy.
Yeah, Alberta is in bad shape.
It is, absolutely.
And Saskatchewan is not unaffected either.
No,
No. So I think a new direction should be considered.
Absolutely.
All right. Great, Alec. Thank you very much. And we're going to push on here now to Rafiq. And we've got a couple of things. Well, we're basically looking at Bangladesh.
Yes.
And it's... you know, Bangladesh, generally speaking, doesn't get too much press, I don't think.
Bangladeshi people has a constitutional right to free expression, but suddenly it's something came up last year in December.
Mm-hmm.
Bangladesh government brought a new media policy that's like controls of free expression. That's hard for the media. And to let actually the audience know that what about Bangladesh and what is the situation of the media? Bangladesh has like 160 million people in a tiny South Asian country, but Bangladeshi people like to talk, like to write, and so the media came up there with the freedom. And what kind of media? It's almost 300 private TV station we like in Bangladesh, right? And 14 radio stations, 300 magazines, 50 daily newspapers, including 8 English newspapers. So it's sort of they have their right to talk, to write everything. But the government, made a policy that you cannot talk against the government regulation or something, and you cannot publish any photos or videos that could tarnish the image of government. That came up, and that's like is the policy is a frontal assault on media freedom.
When you say it's a policy, is it just sort of an edict, something that the government has said, or is it a law?
It is a law.
It is a law. Okay.
It is a law. So, it's first the government brought the policy, and within maybe 3 or 4 months, they made a law. It's a law now. You cannot talk. For example, last year, one very well-known chief editor of a daily newspaper, says Mahmudur Rahman, he was talking about or criticizing the government activities.
Right.
And he was arrested and he's in the jail.
So how is this going to work when you have an election?
Well,
is it going to be illegal to campaign against the government? I mean, this doesn't make sense.
That's what is happening in Bangladesh. And this is only for the election too. Elections happened last year, January 5th.
Mm-hmm.
And hundreds of people died that day because there's no opposition party.
Really?
And opposition party brought the blockade and bans and strikes. So it's killed the people. It's like it's brought the world attention for that elections. And this year, January 5th, was the first or 1 year celebration for the government.
Mm-hmm.
And from that day till even yesterday, I can't tell exactly, but it's 128 people died unless 2 months or 3 months. That's what is happening. And media, couldn't bring all this stuff. That's what is happening in Bangladesh now.
So media can't even comment on the deaths that would happen on election day or whatever. I guess it would depend. They could say, oh, some people died, but not say that it's
this
because of what the government's doing.
Right.
That's what is happening. People died, but we're not sure why.
That's what is happening in Bangladesh. Wow. And even if I made a quote from what says Brad Adams, Asian director of Human Rights Watch, he says it's empires an increasingly authoritarian state with tools go after critics, and it needs to be revoked if the government is serious about its commitment and freedom. Actually, this, like all Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, or whoever is working in international organizations, government even didn't even listen to them.
Do they have a parliament, or what do they have
there? They have, but it's all government. They made a parliament. It's kind of, most of them are the government-related parties.
Do they have any,
no opposition party now.
There's no party, but, I mean, is there anybody elected there who is not a member of the government? Like, do they have any independent members?
Well, independent members, but you can't actually talk, or you cannot do anything against the government policy because you are not majority. Like, let's say 4 or 5 people, they're like nobody.
Wow.
That is what is happening in Bangladesh and the media.
Okay, and one other thing that we have to talk about the situation in terms, again, it's freedom of expression. We have an American blogger, I'm not saying that right, Roy.
Abhijit Roy.
Abhijit Roy. He's an American citizen, but he was born in Bangladesh.
Right.
And he was blogging, and he's been killed.
Just recently, last week. And it's unbelievably, it took world attention, world media, because of U.S. citizen. And the reason he got killed, and his wife, actually in hospital too, she had a head injury at the same time, and she lost one finger from this incident.
Mm-hmm.
And Abhijit Roy was a blogger, an anti-extremist Muslims are. Fundamentalist that he was writing about. And what I heard, he was a award-winning a blogger. And he always used to write anti-Islamic or anti-religious stuff. That's the reason the fundamentalists are giving him the threatening to kill. But because he is a U.S. citizen, he's based in Atlanta, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody can reach him. But as soon as he got in Bangladesh last month, and there is a book fair, national book fair in Dhaka, Bangladesh, in the capital, and he got killed in front of a lot of people in a sidewalk. Mm-hmm. And police was there also. The news says the police had nothing to do, and he got killed. And now FBI in Bangladesh right now for investigating or helping the police.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happened. And the reason again is freedom of expression or what happened in Paris, not in Bangladesh. However, the people are free thinker, free talker, free blogger that can write against the fundamentalist, against the extremist, then they got killed anywhere. And he got killed in Bangladesh because the Bangladeshi political situation is not even good. That's another reason to got killed, and government has nothing to do.
I'm just looking at some of your notes here. And one of them that's interesting is that
Islam is Bangladesh's state religion, but the country is governed by secular laws based on British common law.
Yes.
And Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina has repeatedly said she will not give in to religious extremism. I don't think she's doing a real good job here.
See? That's what she said. But yeah. she couldn't even control anything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
She had no power to control. So the government, the police, in front of police, somebody got killed, and you have nothing to do, so what she can do?
Yeah.
And she had no right. Actually, the election actually brought all these incidents or accidents or killing or death, or the economy in Bangladesh went down in the history only for that elections, mm-hmm. and because of the opposition parties coming with threading like ban, strike, and hartal. It says hartal. No car, no business, no export is going on in Bangladesh, and you can't even talk in the media. And that's what the story.
Well, Rafiq, we've run out of time here. I want to thank you very much, and thank all the rest of our participants here. We had yourself and Eric and Alec and Ashley and Creighton, and I want to thank you all for coming. Before we go, I just want to encourage you and everyone to buy a Look and Listen lottery ticket for CJTR. Grand prize. We've run out of time here. I'll just tell you what the grand prize is. A trip for two to London, 7 days. All kinds of good things are going to happen there. Check out the details at CJTR's website. Go to cjtr.ca. And we're going to shut things down here now. And Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."